somebody, will rise up, profane the fortified temple, Jerusalem, and they, his forces, will stop the daily offering and set up the abomination of desolation. Verse 32 continues, with smooth words he will seduce those who act wickedly against the covenant. Which covenant? The Torah. Those who act wickedly against the covenant, but the people who know their God will stand strong and ultimately prevail.
You're listening to Solace Radio on the Meander Radio Network.
Matthew 24, verse 15. That's on page 935. That's a part of your reading at this point, assignment at this point in time. And Messiah says, so when you see the abomination of desolation, which was spoken of through the Daniel the prophet standing in the holy place, let the reader understand. You've got to understand the abomination of desolation spoken of by the prophet Daniel. You've got to. You've got to understand that to understand what I'm telling you in Matthew 24, right? So this message is all about the abomination that causes desolation spoken of by the prophet Daniel in hopes that you can understand it. Because if you don't understand it, you're not paying attention to what Yeshua said. Make sure you understand this, because if you don't, you're not going to understand what I'm telling you, which was recorded in Matthew 24. So when was this spoken? Well, it was in Daniel chapter 11, which is on page 814 in TLV, which is the type of Bible we use in this congregation, verse 31. And it says, his forces will rise up and profane the fortified temple. They will stop the daily offering and set up the abomination of desolation. All right? It's talking about a very specific thing that's going to happen. Yeshua said, when you see the abomination of desolation spoken of by the prophet Daniel, standing in the holy place, make sure you understand. So you go back, okay, when was it Daniel to speak about this? Right there, somebody, will rise up, profane the fortified temple, Jerusalem, and they, his forces, will stop the daily offering and set up the abomination of desolation. Verse 32 continues, with smooth words he will seduce those who act wickedly against the covenant. Which covenant? The Torah. Those who act wickedly against the covenant, but the people who know their God will stand strong and ultimately prevail. All right? Now, we're going to look at the prophet Daniel, who is not considered a prophet by the Jewish people, but was considered a prophet by the Messiah. He is not in the prophetic portion of Scripture, Nevi'im. He is in Ketuvim. He was a captive in Babylon, where he wrote this, and he is not considered a prophet. He wrote a prophetic book. So he's going to be in the writings in a Tanakh, for example. But Messiah said he was a prophet, so you play with that any way you want. The Jewish community doesn't think he's a prophet. They think he wrote a prophetic book. In chapter 2, page 801, you have the interpretation of the statue that spelled out all of the kingdoms, beginning with Babylon, all the way to the point we're going to be talking about today, Greece, the Greek nation. And in that interpretation and explanation of that, the king Nebuchadnezzar, in verse 46, the king Nebuchadnezzar fell on his face and paid homage to Daniel and gave orders that an offering and incense be provided for him. Not to him, but for him, so he could take an offering to his God. All right? So it's what happened in this time. Verse 47, in response, the king said to Daniel, surely your God is the God of gods, the Lord of kings, and the revealer of mysteries, for you are able to reveal this secret. The secret was the dream that he had had, right? Now, what you need to see is, surely your God is the God of gods and the Lord of kings and the revealers of mysteries. So when you read the book of Daniel, you are reading mysteries. And a lot of the terminology and words are a little bit mysterious. However, we have the God who is the revealer of mysteries, so it's not meant to be mysterious to you, because you have the God who is the revealer of mysteries, but when you read it, it's a little bit mysterious, the type of terminology that's used, because that's the standpoint of this particular writer. Do you understand that? Okay? Key scriptures that we're going to be unpackaging. Daniel chapter 7, page 808, verse 8. While I was pondering the horns, behold, another horn, a small one, sprang up between them, and three of the first horns were uprooted before it. And behold, the horn had eyes, resembling human eyes, and a mouth speaking boastfully. Sounds a little bit mysterious. There's horns, okay? There's another horn, it's a small one, but it sprang up between them, and then uprooted three of the horns that were before it. And in chapter, to get down to verse 24, which is on the next page, page 809, still in chapter 7 of Daniel. As for the 10 horns, out of this kingdom, 10 kings will rise. Another will rise after them, but he will be different from the previous ones. He will subdue 3 kings. There's the interpretation of the mystery. What's the horns? Well, the 10 horns are 10 kings. And there's another that will arise after them, but he'll be different from the previous one. They'll still subdue the 3 kings. So the horns, the beginning of the chapter, are actually kings, right? A total of 10. 3 subdued by the one that's different from the others. All right? Real simple stuff. I'm a simple person. Chapter 8, page 810 in the TLV. What's the next scripture? Just give it to me. Is that the next scripture? Okay, verse 25. That's keep me honest. Still in chapter 7, verse 25. He will speak words against the Most High. He will continue to harass the Kedoshim. So, it's giving you insight into this king. Now I know where I'm not looking at my notes. He will speak words against the Most High. He's going up against God. He will continually harass the Holy Ones. The Kedoshim. The Holy Ones. And will try to change the appointed times in the law. Try to change everything that's in the Torah. The Kedoshim will be handed over him for a time, times, and half a time. A lot of you came out of the evangelical church. You all know what this means. What's times, times, and half a time? 3.5 years. A time, 1 year, times 2 years, half a time is a half year. 3.5 years. You all heard about 3.5 years. This is where it comes from. All right? And who's going to be handed over? The Kedoshim, the Holy Ones. They will ultimately prevail. But for 3.5 years, going to be trouble, right? Now we're to chapter 8, which is on page 810. Verse 23, now toward the end of their reign, when the measure of transgressions plead, a stern-faced king, a master of treating rule, to their end of their reign, these other horns, these other kings, then there's another king that comes up, a master of intrigue. He will arise, verse 24, his power will be mighty, but will not be by his strength alone. He will cause extraordinary devastation and exceed whatever he does. He will destroy both the powerful and the holy people. He will destroy the powerful. He's going to actually get rid of 3 kings and the holy people, the Kedoshim, who's going to really have a hard time under him. Verse 25. By his cunning, he will cause deceit to prosper under his hand, and he will consider himself superior. He will destroy many, taking them unaware. They're unaware because people don't pay attention to the times and they miss things. He will even stand up against the Prince of Princes. Now, the Prince of Princes, not the King of Kings. The Prince of Princes. We know he's going to stand up against the Most High. He's going to go up against God. This is not talking about going up against God. God, we're dealing with God. You're dealing with the King of Kings. You're dealing with the Messiah. You're dealing with the King of Kings. This is the Prince of Princes. This is a man. I'll give you a hint. It's a high priest who is the Prince of Princes. So he will stand up against the Prince of Princes, yet he will be broken, but not with human hands, not with human hands, which brings you to Daniel 9, which is on page 812. This is a 70-week prophecy. If you've been in any evangelical church, a lot of them have these things on explaining end-time prophecy, and they all have their charts, and the different churches have different charts. But they all run about the same thing, and they all stem from the 70th week of Daniel. I would like to walk through this whole prophecy, but we just don't have time. But we're just going to take the 70th week, which is in verse 27. Then he, who will make a firm covenant with many for 1 week, but in the middle of the week he will put an end to the sacrifice and offering and a wing of on a wing of abominations will come one who destroys until the decreed annihilation is poured out on the one who destroys. It's the same thing. Put it in context. It's the same horn. It's the same king. Different from all the other horns. Different from all the other kings. He will make a covenant with many for 1 week, a 7-year period, right? But in the middle of the week, he'll put an end to the sacrifice and offering and on a wing of abomination. In other words, he's going to do the abomination that causes desolation. Until the decreed annihilation is poured out on the one who destroys. So this one who's destroying is going to be annihilated eventually, but not for 7 years. It's going to be 7 years of tribulation. The last half of the 7 years is going to be really bad. And you all know that. Trouble is, you all think it's future. It's like, no, put it in context. It's always talking about the same thing. You got 10 kings. That one's different from others, going to undo three, right? It's just real simple thought. Verse 29, still in Daniel 11. At the appointed time, he will invade the south again, but only this time the outcome will not be as before. I can't teach everything in one thing. This king that's different from all the other kings, will invade the south once again. Everything's centered in Jerusalem, okay? You're in Israel, you go south, what do you get? Egypt. At an appointed time, there's a time when he is going to do this. It is appointed. He will invade Egypt again. But this time the outcome will be different than it was before. That's how you know he's going to invade it again. Because it's going to be a different outcome than the last time. So he's going to invade it more than once, or at least try to invade it more than once. But this time it's going to be a little bit different. Verse 30, I'm guessing. The ships of Kittim will come against him and he will lose heart. In other words, opposition. From Egypt, right? He will lose heart, then he will turn back and vent his rage against the Holy Covenant. He tried to do Egypt, it didn't work, he's going to go against Jerusalem. When he returns, he will favor those who forsake the Holy Covenant. He's going to go with those of us who forsake the Holy Covenant, verse 31. His forces will rise up and profane the fortified temple. They will stop the daily offering and set up the abomination that causes desolation. Oh, now we know it's going to happen. It's going to happen after a failed attempt to invade Egypt. And now we're going to have the abomination that causes desolation. Verse 32. With smooth words, he will seduce those who act wickedly against the covenant. In other words, there's a lot of corruption among our people. He's going to be seducing us, but the people who know their God will stand strong and ultimately prevail, although there's going to be 7 years of tribulation. The last 3 years are going to be really rough, right? Verse 33, those who are wise among the people will instruct many, though for many days they will fall by the sword and be burned, captured, or pillaged. In other words, there's going to be a faithful remnant who are going to go through tribulation. A lot of tribulation. For many days. It's a 7 year period here. The last half is really bad. They will fall by the sword, be burned, captured, or pillaged. Verse 34. When they stumble, they receive a little help, but many will join them deceitfully. In other words, some people rally to them, but there's a lot of intrigue going on because there's a lot of corruption among our people historically at this point in time. Verse 35. Even some of the wise will stumble, so they may be refined, purified, and made spotless until the time of the end. For it will still come at the appointed time. The end of what? The end of the tribulation they're going through right now. The end of the tribulation. Okay, now, it's talking about Antiochus. He has many names. He's Antiochus the Fourth. He is Antiochus Epiphanes. He's a Greco-Syrian. You have the whole story of Alexander, if you're from the West, Alexander the Great. If you're from the East, Alexander the Conqueror. He had a great Greek kingdom when he died. His kingdom was divided into four kingdoms. This is the Greco-Syrian end of it. Which was based in what is today Syria, controlled what is today Israel, went all the way down to the border of Egypt. And it's going to be in the book of the Maccabees. So we wade into it, understanding when these things happen. And you need to try to, that's what I said, you want to take notes. These are the key things to understand. First Maccabees 1, verse 54. On the 15th day of Kislev, everyone say the 15th day of Kislev. That's an important date, isn't it? You're Jewish, you know it. If you're in this congregation long enough, you actually know that, right? In the year 154, the king built an appalling abomination on top of the altar of burnt offerings, and altars were built in the surrounding towns of Judah. So you have the king, who is at this point in time actually Antiochus, or Antiochus IV, or Antiochus Epiphanes. He's going to build something on the altar. It's the altar of Holocaust. It's the altar of burnt offering. He's building something on top of that altar. It is not the abomination that causes desolation. It's an abomination on the altar where sacrifice is brought in Jerusalem. And he did that on the 15th of Kislev. All right? Verse 55. And incense was offered at the doors of houses and on the streets. Well, the incense is supposed to be only in the holy place. Now it's happening all over town because now we're being apostate as a people. Verse 56. Any books of the law that came to light were turned up and burned. You found a Torah scroll. What do? You tear it up, you burn it. Right? Verse 57. Whenever anyone was discovered possessing a copy of the covenant or practicing the law, a Greek interpretation, the king's decree sentenced them to death. No more Torah. Verse 58. Month after month, they took harsh action against any offenders they discovered in the towns of Israel. In other words, someone's trying to be faithful to God is going to be punished. Tribulation. Verse 59. On the 25th day of each month, sacrifice was offered in the altar erected on top of the altar of burnt offering. In other words, bad offerings on an altar that is defiled. The wrong kind of offerings to the wrong gods. Largely, verse 60. Women who had their children circumcised were put to death, according to the edict. Verse 61, with their babies hung around their necks, the members of their household and those who had performed circumcision, everyone was executed. No more circumcision. It's tribulation, you understand. Verse 62, yet there were many in Israel who stood firm and found courage to refuse unclean food, because one of the biggest things they pushed was the eating of swine flesh. And you had to resist that. Verse 63, they chose death rather than contamination by such fare and profanation of the Holy Covenant, and they were executed. Because the Holy Ones are there, but they're going to suffer through 7 years of tribulation. The last half of that's really going to be a mess. Verse 64, it was truly dreadful retribution that visited Israel. Who is Israel? The faithful. Because most of Israel was Hellenized. They got into the Greek culture. They were apostate. True Israel. There was a dreadful retribution because it was a judgment of God. Because even the retribution of evil people are ultimately the judgment of God because God allows it. Okay? When you talk about they chose death rather than to eat swine's flesh or profane the Holy Covenant, they were put to death. That's a fulfillment of the prophet we read in Daniel chapter 11, page 814, verse 32, with smooth words, he will seduce those who act wickedly against the covenant, but the people who know their God will stand strong and eventually prevail. But it's going to take 7 years of tribulation, the last half pretty messy. Now, we're going to walk through the books of the Maccabees. You have to remember, it's not in chronological order, so if you try to read it just the way it's written, no, you can't do that. You got to pay attention to what's being talked about and plug it in the appropriate thing. It's a pretty sloppily written book. And so here's what you have happening. After the division of the Greek kingdom, when Alexander died, there are going to be a total of seven Greco-Syrian kings. Begins with Seleucus Nicator, and goes all the way down to Seleucus the Fourth. Get the numbers right. Seleucus the Fourth. All those would precede Antiochus, who is Antiochus the Fourth, or Antiochus Epiphanes. Three more would be uprooted by the despotic Antiochus. So you have a total of 10, right? The one Antiochus is different from all the others. He's going to uproot three. Daniel 7, verse 7. After this is my vision at night, look, behold, there was a fourth beast, terrifying, frightening, tremendously strong, large iron teeth that divided and devoured and crushed anything that was left. It trampled his feet. It was different from all the other beasts that came before it. It had 10 horns. What's he talking about? He's talking about everything he's been talking about all along. There's a total of 10. There's one who's different. He's a beast. Now he's not just a horn or a horn with eyes. He's a beast because this guy is an animal. This guy's an animal. And he had 10 horns. Why? There's a total of 10 kingdoms. There's a total of 10 kingdoms, right? Down in verse 24. As for the 10 horns, out of the kingdoms, 10 kings will rise. Another will rise after him. He will differ from the previous one. He'll subdue three kings. You see, it's all in context. Just put it all in context. seems mysterious, but God is the revealer of mysteries, so it's not that mysterious. It's really simple if you follow out what's being talked about, right? Are you with me? So he's going to subdue three kings. Demetrius was the son of Seleucus the Fourth. Okay? Seleucus the Fourth died the way that most kings died. He was murdered. He inherited the throne. When you inherit thrones in this kingdom, there's a hierarchy, right? One, and when he dies, somebody else comes. When he dies, somebody else comes. And what tended to happen, if you were down the line, you can move yourself up. You can move yourself up. So when Seleucus the Fourth dies, it's time for Demetrius to become the king. But Antiochus, who was down the road, betrayed him and turned him over to Rome down in Egypt, and they held him for ransom. But Antiochus wasn't next in line. Next in line was Heliodorus. Heliodorus, who is, by the way, the one who bumped off Seleucus IV, got to be the king. His problem was Antiochus, the little brother, was right behind him. He only lasted a couple weeks. And then there was a bunch of intrigue, and he was just kind of moved aside. When he was moved aside, though, that would have made Antiochus the king, except Demetrius escaped from the Romans and came back and was reinstated as the king. No more intrigue. Antiochus' little brother murdered him, and he was king. Three kings, right? He took care of them. He's one of the seven, different from all the others. He finally gets to be king. A lot of things going on to do that. A lot of things going on. It's a messy thing. The key person in all this is Onias the Third. Onias the Third, most people haven't heard of. He's the prince of princes. He's the high priest. He was called Sarhaam, the prince of our people. When Antiochus the Fourth became the king, when he ascended the throne, our high priest was Onias the Third. He upheld the holy covenant of God. He resisted the Hellenization that was put upon us from the time of Alexander the Conqueror, who had tried to press us into Hellenization, taking on all the Greek culture. And Antiochus was pushing it even harder. He's a little bit more brutal. He's different from all the other ones. He starts small but got big. And he's brutal. And he just stood against all that. He had a little brother too. His name was Joshua. He got Hellenized. He took the name Jason. He didn't like his holy brother being the high priest. And because he was Hellenized, simple way to take care of that, goes to the king, Antiochus the Fourth, and says, here's the bribe. I want to be the high priest. So he exchanged money, and Onias was put into exile. He was put into exile. And almost immediately, the Jewish nation was transformed into a microcosm of the Hellenistic culture that surrounded it. Because now our high priest was saying, yes, let's go this direction. And at the behest of Antiochus says, I really want you to make Jerusalem a Greek city. All of you have been on a tour. Remember the model of Jerusalem at the Second Temple period? Remember the gymnasiums down over the hill, down below the city of David? That big gymnasium? Jason built that. Because we were a Greek, Jerusalem was a Greek city now. We needed a gymnasium. And he persuaded the people to swear allegiance to Grecian gods. Yes, we have a god in Israel, but there's a lot more Greek gods. Let's just embrace them all. Because after all, they're all the same. And he effectively turned Jerusalem into a Greek ghetto. Became a Greek ghetto. His treacherous betrayal bought him a total of 3 years, because an even larger bribe to Antiochus transformed the priesthood to the maniacal Menelaus. He was an absolute maniac that caused a lot of problems, who subsequently orchestrated the murder of Onias a half a year after his exile. A half a time after his exile. These are important things because everything is an appointed time, right? That's in 2 Maccabees chapter 4, verse 34. Menelaus then had a quiet word with Andronicus, urging him to get rid of Aeneas. Andronicus sought out Aeneas, resorting to a trick of offering his right hand and oaths, succeed in persuading him, despite the latter's lingering suspicions, to leave the sanctuary, whereupon, in defiance of all justice, he immediately put him to death. When did that happen? 6 months after he had been exiled. This holy one, this prince of princes, he is put to death. It is the death of the prince of princes that we read about earlier, right? That was the beginning of the 7-year tribulation period. You're now into the 7-year tribulation period. Some of you have been taught it's future. I'm telling you, it's happened then with the death of Aeneas. That's the key to it. Daniel 8, verse 9, page 810 in the TLV. Out of one of them came a small horn which grew extremely large to the south and the east and toward the beautiful land. Now you have this horn. Started small, a king, started small, grew large, spread out to the south, to the east, and toward the beautiful land. You're dealing with Antiochus. Antiochus, Daniel 7, page 808, verse 8. While I was pondering the horns, behold, another horn, a small one, sprang up between them. And three of the first horns were uprooted before it. And behold, this horn had eyes resembling human eyes and a mouth speaking boastfully. That's Antiochus, the small horn that became the big horn. Down to chapter 8, verse 11. It set itself up as great as the prince of the host. Now you're dealing with the prince of the host. He's becoming like God. And it took away from him the daily offering in the place of the sanctuary was thrown down. Temple was thrown down. Verse 12. The host was given over to along with the daily sacrifice, the course of rebellion. It will hurl truth to the ground and prosper in what it does. What's it? It's this horn. It's this king. It is Antiochus. He's going to prosper. And he's going to be absolutely anti-temple. Daniel 11, verse 31, page 814. His force will rise up and profane the fortified temple. They will stop the daily offering, set up the abomination that causes desolation. You got to understand that, which is why I'm teaching it to you. So you understand it. Verse 32. With smooth words, he will seduce those who act wickedly against the covenant, but the people who know their God will stand strong and eventually prevail after the 7 years of tribulation. Back to chapter 8. Something I missed that I want you to pick up. That's page 810, verse 13. Then I heard a holy one speaking. Another holy one said to the one who's speaking, how long will the vision last? What's the vision? It's the vision of this particular segment of time in the Greco-Syrian kingdom, particularly with Antiochus. How long will this vision last? The daily sacrifice be forsaken because of the rebellion. The rebellion is the Jewish people rebelling against God, by the way. And the sanctuary be surrendered and the host be trampled. How long? It's a great question, right? How long is this going to last? We know it's going to start, starting with Aeneas, but how long is it going to last? Verse 14. Then he said to me, for 2300 evenings and mornings, then the sanctuary will be vindicated. So how long will it last? 2300 days. That's how long it's going to last. The murder of Aeneas marks the beginning of 2300 evenings and mornings. He is the prince of princes. He is he's one of the Kedoshim, one of the holy ones. It will end 2300 evenings and days later with the death of Antiochus Epiphanes. All right? Now, things start to happen. You're in the tribulation period. And you walk through, you're seeing the years. The first major massacre took place in the year 170 BCE, before the Common Era. Christians in the West say have a BC and AD. I don't know what any of that means. The Jewish community has before the Common Era and the Common Era. Before the Common Era, you go back 170 BCE, there's a massacre, terrible massacre. In 169, Antiochus himself marched in person against Jerusalem and executed a tremendous bloodbath and looted some of the treasures out of our temple at that point in history. In 168, Antiochus took another expedition against Egypt. He had tried some earlier ones, didn't do real well. Who controlled Egypt? Rome. because the Roman Empire had taken all of northern Africa, and the Roman Empire ended at the border with Egypt and Israel. The Greco-Syrians head down to the border on the other side. All right? You're dealing with the Greeks and the Romans right there at the border. So he goes down against Jerusalem. It's a real famous story. He runs into a Roman general, Popilius Laenas. And at that point, he presents him with a degree from the Roman Senate, which required him to abandon his designs on Egypt once and for all. Quit messing with Egypt. It's a part of Rome. And quote, if you wish to avoid being regarded an enemy of Rome. You have to do this unless you wish to be regarded as an enemy of Rome. You come against Egypt, you're coming against Rome, and the Senate has decreed you will be labeled an enemy of Rome. Antiochus replied, he'd like to think that over a little bit. Popilius gave him one of the most famous brief ultimatums on history that most people in the East are familiar with, probably not most people in the West, pulled out a spear and drew a circle around him in the sand around his feet and said, make up your mind here. This is Antiochus, one of the most arrogant people on the face of the earth. And now he's standing in front of a Roman legion with a general who says, make up your mind here. He is embarrassed and he goes into a rage. And he's going to vent his fury. He has two options. He can take on Rome or he can go back to Jerusalem. Okay? And so he decides he's going to kill somebody. And we're going to go back and go against Jerusalem and the people who remain loyal to the covenant. 2 Maccabees chapter 5. When the king came to hear of what happened was there was a rumor. There was a rumor that the Roman general had killed him. I'm skipping over some of the story, but I know what the story is. The rumor. The general actually killed him, which means he wasn't in charge. And so you have this maniac high priest who says, aha! I'm in charge. And he does a massacre in Jerusalem, killing people who are loyal to God. And he's carrying out this massacre. Now, Antiochus, who's really ticked off because of what the Roman general did to him, hears there's a rebellion in Jerusalem by this maniacal high priest that had bought the priesthood. So he concluded Judea was in revolt, and he therefore marched from Egypt like a raging wild beast and began storming the city. Verse 12, he then ordered his soldiers to cut down without mercy everyone they encountered, to butcher all who took refuge in their houses. Verse 13, it was a massacre of young and old, slaughter of women and children, a butchery of girls, infants, just kill everybody. Verse 14, there were 80,000 victims in the course of 3 days, 40,000 dying by violence, as many again being sold into slavery. So, here's what's happening. You're to the year 167. Exactly 3 years after the murder of Aeneas, who had been in exile for half a year. Time, times, and half a time. All right? Exactly 3 years until you have the ultimate sacrilege befall the temple in Jerusalem. The armed forces of Antiochus rose up against the temple. They abolished the daily sacrifice and set up the abomination that causes desolation. With impunity, he emptied the temple treasury. He sacrificed a pig on the altar. The altar had already had something built on top of it. It was a profanation. Now it's completely defiled by the blood of a pig. And he dedicates the temple to a foreign god. He erects a statue of Zeus in the holy place, the most holy place, or the Holy of Holies. All right? Hellenized Jews at this point in time took the mark of the Greco-Syrian beast. They took his mark. How do you take the mark of the beast? 1 Maccabees 1:43. Many of the Israelites chose to accept his religion, sacrificing to idols and profaning the Sabbath. They took the mark of the beast, the Greco-Syrian beast. 1 Maccabees 1:52. Many of the people, that is the apostate from the law, every apostate, they were all apostate, they were Hellenized, rallied to them and committed evil in the country. 53. Forcing Israel into hiding places of refuge. 54. On the 15th day of Kislev. That sound familiar? Remember the 15th day of Kislev. important verse, the year 154. If you read this in the Catholic Bible, it won't say it's the year 154. It'll say it's the year 145 because this is where they switched the Hebrew around a little bit to make it an anagram about the Lord of Lords. I can't teach all that, but it is different, and it's different because that's after we vanquish Antiochus. And so it's there. And if you go to a Catholic scholar, which there aren't many of those around anymore, say, well, this is where it's an idiom. It's a pun. It's something. They understand it's there, but they don't understand how a transposition of letters can change things. And it's simply the year 154. The king built an abomination on top of the altar burnt offering. This is not the abomination that causes desolation. This is that abomination on top of the altar. And then the altars were built in surrounding towns of Judah. This is talking about the Hellenization of the people. I'm backing up, you understand, and giving you a picture of what the people were like prior to the abomination of desolation. All right? Verse 55, incense was offered at the doors of houses and streets. Not appropriate. Verse 56, any books of the law came to light, were torn up, were born. Verse 57, whenever any discovered possessing a copy of the covenant practicing law, the king's priest sentenced him to death. Things were going to bad for worse to our people. It was bad enough. But now you have the abomination that causes desolation. You have that which brings in the last half of the 3 years, which is great tribulation. Great tribulation. 2 Maccabees chapter 6 verse 4. The temple was filled with reveling and debauchery by the Gentiles, who took their pleasure with prostitutes and had intercourse with women in the sacred precincts and introducing other indecencies behind. What went on in the temple was unspeakable. It was just a Greek thing, and it's just ugly as you can get. Verse 5. The altar of sacrifice was loaded with victims proscribed by the law as profane. They weren't offering anything kosher. Everything's a profanation. It's the great tribulation now. Verse 6. No one might either keep the Sabbath or observe the tradition of feasts or so much as admit to being a Jew. Hellenized Jews willingly honored the god of self-gratification and libido. It was a lot more fun than the strict laws of the Torah. Those who revered the god of Abraham and Isaac, counting their lives not worthy even unto death, in the books of the Maccabees are full of accounts about their sacrifices and their martyrdom. And you'll read story after story after story if you read through these books. 2 Maccabees 6, verse 10, verse 7. People were driven to harsh compulsion to take part in monthly ritual and meal commemorating the king's birthday. When the feast of Dionysus, you're dealing with Greek gods, occurred, they were forced to wear ivy wreaths and walk in Dionysiac procession. Everyone was just getting into the Greek thing. I'm not in my notes, so just go where I'm supposed to go. I don't know where I'm supposed to go. Chapter 6, verse 10. For example, this is the ones who were trying to be obedient. Two women who were charged with having circumcised their children, they were paraded around town in public with their babies hung around their breast. By the way, their babies were dead at this point in time. And then hurled over the city wall. Verse 11. Other people who had assembled in some nearby caves to keep the seventh day without attracting attention, keep the Sabbath, were denounced to Philip. You had these people that came in, but they turned this in. It was the intrigue that was going on that the prophet talked about. Since their consciousness will not allow them to defend themselves out of respect for the holies this day. In other words, you attack them on Shabbat, they won't fight back. You can just go in and slaughter them. Just go in and slaughter them. 2 Maccabees chapter 7 relates one of the most famous stories you can read. It's about the seven brothers. Antiochus comes into a home. There's seven brothers, and he gets a pan, cooks some swine flesh, and said, eat this. And they said no, so he kills the first brother. Cooks the brother. After he cuts off his hand, feet, and tongue. Eat your brother, eat the swine. Nope, kill the second brother. Third brother. Fourth brother. Fifth brother. Sixth brother. Comes down to the seventh brother. You can read this all in chapter 7. It's a very famous story. This is the Great Tribulation, you understand. This is Great Tribulation. It's not future. It happened. This is the seventh brother in verse 33. And he's talking to Antiochus. And if to punish and discipline us, our living Lord is briefly angry with us, he will be reconciled with us in due course. You're killing us all, but this is the judgment of God, and God will take care of it because God will eventually reconcile us. Verse 34. But you, unholy wretch and wicked as the villain. Now he's talking to Antiochus. Okay, this is strong language to this kind of a despot, you understand? What cause have you for pride, nourishing vain hopes and raising your hand against his servants? Verse 35. For you have not yet escaped the judgment of God the Almighty, the All-Seeing. You think you're in charge, but we serve the real God. Verse 36. Our brothers, having endured brief pain for the sake of ever-flowing life, have died for the covenant of God, the brothers who all died before him. While you, by God's judgment, will have to pay for this, for the just penalty for your arrogance. Verse 37. I too, like my brothers, surrender my body and life for the laws of my ancestors, which is the Torah, begging God to quickly take pity on our nations, and by trials and afflictions to bring you to confess that he alone is God. He intercedes. He's killing us, but I'm praying that you learn that we serve the only true God. Verse 38. So that with my brothers and myself, there may be an end to the wrath of the Almighty, rightly let loose on the whole nation. Yeah, God is judging us, and he's right to judge us. We deserve it. Verse 39. The king fell into a rage and treated this one more cruelly than the others, if you can believe that. For he himself was smarting from the young man's scorn. He really got under his skin. Verse 40. So the last brother met his end undefiled and with perfect trust in the Lord. The dying prayer of the seventh brother found its answer in the Maccabean revolt. That's where this prayer was answered. Against all odds, savage Jews purposed to resist the Syrian juggernaut that was upon us. The Jewish priest Mattathias had a total of 5 sons. Judas, Jonathan, John, Simon, and Eleazar. That was the 5 sons of a righteous priest. They refused to make sacrifice to the Greco-Syrian gods. They refused to be Hellenized. With valor, they implored the Hasidim, the pious ones, the holy ones, to join them in a battle against Hellenization. They weren't in a battle against Antiochus. They were a battle against Hellenization. We are Jews, not Greeks. When a Hellenizing Jew sacrificed in accordance with the command of Antiochus, and I quote, Mattathias and his sons took out broad-bladed knives and cut the men down, killing the king's officer and his soldiers. And after overturning a pagan altar, Mattathias cried out, whoever is zealous for the laws of our country and the worship of God, let him follow me. Let him follow me, and we will defend ourselves on Shabbat. Mattathias died in the spring of 166 BCE. We're walking down the years, right? He dies, but not before he appointed his indomitable son, Judas Maccabeus, Judah the Hammer, as leader of the fledgling Jewish resistant forces. 1 Maccabees 3, verse 1. His son Judas, known as Maccabeus, then took his place. Verse 2. All his brothers and those who had attached themselves to his father supported him, and they fought Israel. They fought for Israel with a will. Verse 3. He extended the fame of his people like a giant. He put on the breastplate and buckled his war harness. He engaged in battle after battle, protecting the ranks with his sword. Verse 4. He was like a lion in exploits, like a young lion roaring over his prey. Verse 5. He pursued and tracked down renegades and consigned those who troubled his people to the flames. Verse 6. The renegades quailed with terror as he inspired. All evildoers were utterly confounded, and deliverance went forward under his leadership. He was the anointed prince that was going to come. He was Moshiach, the anointed one who was going to come and redeem the temple, fulfilling all of the 70th week of Daniel. Verse 7, he brought bitterness to many a king and rejoicing to Jacob by his deeds. His memory is blessed forever and ever. All right, 1 Maccabees 3, verse 34. To him, Antiochus made over half his forces. Antiochus is up in Syria, which is his capital. Divides his army in half. Okay? Divides his army in half. Gives him the elephants, which is a very Greek thing. Give him instructions about what he wanted done, particularly in regard to the inhabitants of Judea and Jerusalem. This Maccabean revolt. We got to crush this. He's going to send half his army down. Verse 35. I'm not looking at my notes at all. Again, against whom he was to send a force to crush and destroy the power of Israel and the remnant of Jerusalem, to wipe out their very memory from the place. Kill all the Jews. Everyone keeps trying to do that. Everyone's always trying to kill us. Verse 36. to settle the foreigners in all parts of the territory and distribute their land into lots. No Jews, Judenfried, no Jews in Israel. That would make everybody happy today. Verse 37. The king took the remaining half of his troops with him, sent out from Antioch, the capital of his kingdom, the year 147. He crossed the river Euphrates and made his way through the upper provinces. He's going up into Iraq. Half the armies he's sending south, right? The other half he's swinging north into Iraq. He's doing all kind of wars. Judas is going to run into that half of an army that came down. Judas Maccabees and Judas Christians forced to run victory and offer up hymns and praises and extolling the majesty to a mighty God and reveling in that. And they sang a song that was taken from Proverbs chapter 21, page 719, verses, just go to the next verse. Okay, verse 38 of chapter 3 of 1 Maccabees. Lysias chose Ptolemy, son of Dorymenus, with Nicator and Gorgias, influential men from among the friends of the king. This is the army that's coming south. Verse 39, and under the command they dispatched 40,000 foot and 7,000 horse to invade the land of Judah and devastate it as the king had ordered. Then there's a song. I should look at my notes. Let me flip some pages and see where I am. There I am. Here's a song they sang. There is no wisdom, there is no understanding, there is no counsel against Adonai. Verse 31, a horse is prepared for the day of battle, but victory comes from Adonai. Victory comes from Adonai. 1 Maccabees 4, verse 34. The two forces engaged, 5,000 men from Lysias' troops fell in hand-to-hand fighting. Immediately slaughters 5,000 troops right in front lines. Verse 35. Seeing the rout of his army and the courage of Judas' troops and their readiness to live or die, nobly, Lysias withdrew to Antioch, went back to Syria, where he recruited mercenaries for a further invasion of Judea and even greater strength. Verse 36. Judas and his brothers then said, now their enemies have been defeated, let's go and purify the sanctuary and dedicate it. After all, Daniel prophesied this. There will be an anointed one, Mashiach, who will come and restore the temple in Jerusalem. When did it happen? 25th of Kislev, the year 148 BCE. Exactly 7 years after Antiochus orchestrated the murder of Onias, and 3 years after he had done the abomination of desolation in the temple on the same date. You have to add the half year that happened before that with the exiling of the prince of princes, Onias III. So you're walking out the 7 years, the time and a half years, the 3.5 years, and you're walking out the great tribulation that happened after that, right? And so he goes up, he's going to rededicate the temple. 1 Maccabees 4:52, on the 25th day of the 9th month of Kislev, the 25th of Kislev. In the year 148, they rose at dawn, verse 53, and offered lawful sacrifice on the new altar to burn offering they had made. They had to get rid of the old altar because it was defiled. Had to build a new altar. It's a whole story there, but we can't do that. Verse 54. The altar was dedicated to the sound of hymns, zithers, lyres, and cymbals at the same time of year and on the same day in which the Gentiles had originally profaned it. Exact same day. I should keep flipping pages. I need somebody to just flip my pages to see if I... Verse 55. The whole people fell prostrate in adoration and praised heaven who had granted them success. Verse 56. For 8 days they celebrated the dedication of the altar joyfully, offering burnt offerings, communion offerings, thanksgiving sacrifices. Verse 57. They ornamented the front of the temple with crowns and bosses of gold, renovated the gates of storerooms, providing the latter with doors. They strengthened the temple proper. Verse 58. There was no end to the rejoicing among the people since disgrace inflicted by the generals had been effaced, had been taken care of. Verse 59. Judas with his brothers and the whole assembly made a law that the days of the dedication of the temple should be celebrated yearly at the proper season for 8 days, beginning with 25th of the month of Kislev, with rejoicing and gladness. And that's called? I'm going to run over. Can I do a little trail right here? There's a nice story about the oil. You have all heard the story of the oil. The oil was only supposed to last 1 day, but it lasted 8 days. Hence, we have a Chanukiah, right? That's cheap Jewish theology. It's a nice story. The kids like it. These people would not be interested with any oil that an apostate, corrupt priesthood had made. It's my opinion. That's a reasonably new story. The older story is that the last festival they couldn't keep because they were at war was Sukkot, the 7-day festival that lasted 8 days. Let's celebrate for 8 days, because Sukkot, the most messianic of festivals, is a time of great rejoicing. Let's keep that festival. Let's do 8 days in the month of Kislev to remember this miracle. But that's not the end of this teaching, because I have to give it to you. Daniel chapter 12, verse 11, page 815. From the time the daily burnt offering is taken away, the abomination of desolation set up, there will be how many? 1,290 days. 1,290 days. Exactly. It's an appointed time. There's 1,290 days from the time the daily burnt offering, you have the abomination of desolation. There's a total of 1,290 days. Now here's what happened. Upon hearing the Jews had regained Jerusalem, Antiochus, who's been swinging up into Iraq, say, wait a minute. Talk about rebellion. They regained Jerusalem? Rededicated the temple? We're going to take care of this. 2 Maccabees chapter 9, verse 4. Flying into a passion, he resolved to make the Jews pay for the disgrace inflicted by those who had routed him. And with this in mind, he ordered his charioteer to drive without stopping and get the journey over. But the sentence of heaven was already hanging over him. In his pride, he had said, when I reach Jerusalem, I shall turn into a mass grave for the Jews. He's going to go from Iraq to Jerusalem nonstop on a chariot. Get there as quick as you can. I'm going to turn into nothing but a graveyard for Jews. But the hand of heaven was right there. Verse 5. The all-seeing Lord, the God of Israel, the terminology of the prayer of the seventh brother, right? The all-seeing Lord, the God of Israel, struck him with an incurable and unseen complaint. The words were hardly out of his mouth when he was seized with an incurable pain in his bowels and with excruciating external torture. He had this internal torture. It just hit him as soon as he said that. Verse 6 points out, this is only right since he inflicted many barbaric tortures on the bowels of others. Okay? Verse 7. Even so, he in no way diminished in his arrogance. Still bursting with pride, breathing fire in his wrath against the Jews, he was in the act of ordering an even keener face. Let's go faster. When the chariot gave a sudden lurch and he fell out in a serious fall and dragged him along, and every joint of his body was wrenched out of place. He's having a rough time. Why? It's the judgment of the God of Israel. Verse 8. He who had only a little while before thought he was in his superhuman boastfulness he would command the waves of the sea. He would imagine he could weigh mountain peaks in the balance, found himself flat on the ground and then being carried in litter, a visible demonstration of all to the power of the God of Israel. Verse 9. In that the very eyes of this godless man teemed with worms and his flesh rotted away while he lingered in agonizing pain, the stench of his decay sickened the whole army. And he would die. He would die. He would die only after recognize the only true God is the God of Israel. He's the only. He knew it. There's only one God. That's the God of Israel. When did he die? On the day that Daniel prophesied he would die. Daniel 12, verse 11. By his cunning, he will cause deceit to prosper under his hand, and he will consider himself superior. He will destroy many, taking them unaware. He will stand up against the prince of princes, yet he will be broken. But not by human hands. Not by human hands. Just go to where I'm supposed to go. I don't know where I'm in my notes. Chapter 12, verse 11. From the time the daily burnt offering is taken away, the abomination of desolation set up, there will be 1,290 days, right? What happens 1,290 days later? Hanukkah. Dedication of the temple. Right? Verse 12. Happy is the one who keeps waiting and reaches 1,335 days. What happens in 1,335 days? Antiochus dies on his way down to search for trouble again. God takes him out. There's another blessing for you. There's nothing but... So that turns us full circle back to Matthew 24, 15, which is where we started. So when you see the abomination of desolation, which is spoken through Daniel the prophet standing in the holy place, make sure that you understand this. Make sure you understand this. You should understand it because it was prophesied. It happened. Everything that was supposed to happen in the 70th week of Daniel happened on the exact appointed time that God said it would happen. What is the abomination of desolation? Or the abomination that causes desolation that Daniel spoke about in the holy place, in the temple in Jerusalem? It starts always will start with the corruption of the priesthood. You see, this is actually what happened in the first temple. It's going to happen twice in the second temple. All right? It's going to be the corruption of the priesthood. And then you're going to have unclean blood defiling the altar. Because your abomination that causes desolation, not just an abomination that causes desolation, that's unclean blood. At this point in time, it was the Greeks doing pig blood on the altar. The third thing, dedication of the temple to a false god. At this point, it was the Greek god Zeus. At this point. And then after all that happens, what happens? Tribulation. Tribulation. It's really that simple, isn't it? Everyone got that picture? So when I start teaching all of Matthew 24, when I get to this verse, I'll just say, you all know what that means. You'll go, yes. Right? You have any questions, ask Amanda. Basic history that you haven't been taught. You don't have to read the book of Maccabees to find this. You have to read the book of Daniel to find this. Ezekiel helps. Okay? The Revelation is not all that helpful. Because the Revelation doesn't have a temple in it. Although you've been taught it does. It really doesn't. There's not another temple coming that's the key to end time prophecy. Simply is. That's right up there with the rapture. You know, no. What does the Bible say? Not what you've been taught. It says, what does it actually say? It's really simple if you just walk it out. So be blessed, everybody. Shabbat shalom.
Our foundation is built on solid rock. Yeshua. The rock of our salvation. On Solace Radio.